So we like to think of science as a collection of facts, you know, like gravity is 9.8 meters per second squared, or that water is H2O.
Right. The mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
Exactly. But if you rewind the clock about 2,600 years, none of those facts existed. And I don't just mean people didn't know them. I mean, the actual method for finding them didn't even exist.
Yeah, there was no science, there was no physics, it was just stories.
Right. If there was a thunderstorm, it wasn't low pressure meeting high pressure. It was Zeus having a bad day. If the crops died, Demeter was mourning. The world was explained by who, not what.
And that is exactly where our story starts today. We are looking at a specific moment in history on the coast of modern-day Turkey, where a handful of people basically decided to fire the gods.
They stopped asking who caused this and started asking how does this work. So today we are doing a deep dive into the pre-Socratics. These are the thinkers, roughly between 600 BC and 400 BC.
And we are basing this analysis on a really fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes covering the beginnings of Greek philosophy.
Right, and our mission here is to understand how these people went from mythology to acting like pre-scientific scientists. Because I have to be honest, when I first saw the source material, I thought, okay, Philly says everything is water. Great. Next.
It does feel a bit like Trivial Pursuit on the surface.
Yeah, it felt like trivia.
But if you dismiss them as just guys who guessed wrong about chemistry, you really miss the point entirely. These thinkers were inventing the very concept of a
A
universe.
universe, like the word itself.
Yeah, universe,
Where?
one turn. It is the idea that despite all the chaos and diversity we see out there, you know, trees and birds and stars,
Yeah.
it is all fundamentally one thing interacting with itself.
They were looking for the unified field theory before they even had microscopes.
Exactly.
So let's set the scene for you listening. Why here and why then?
Ooh.
Why Turkey and not, say, Athens?
Well, geography is destiny here. The Greek colonies in Asia Minor, specifically Miletus, were sitting right on the end of the Meander Valley trade routes.
So it's a crossroads.
A huge crossroads. It was the bottleneck between the mystical East and the pragmatic West.
Meaning you have caravans coming in from Babylon and Egypt and Persia.
And they bring their own creation myths and astronomy and math. If you live in an isolated village,
Yeah.
you think your creation story is the truth. But if you live in Miletus,
You hear 12 different creation stories before breakfast.
right. And eventually you start to think, okay, they can't all be right. Maybe none of them are. Maybe we need to look at the nature of the stuff itself.
And that leads us to Thales, the first guy to take a swing at this. As I mentioned, his big claim to fame is everything is water.
Which creates a bit of a PR problem for him in the modern age.
It really does. It sounds like he just spent too much time at the beach. I mean, I look at this table and my microphone, the air we're breathing, none of it looks like water. So why is he considered a genius and not just a guy who needed glasses?
You have to ignore the answer and look at the process. Thales was doing something radical. He was observing that water is the only substance that naturally exists as a solid, a liquid, and a gas.
Oh, okay.
It transforms. Ice becomes water, water becomes steam.
So he sees a mechanism of change happening right in front of him.
And he sees necessity. Life exists only where there is moisture.
Mm.
So he hypothesized, what if everything is just water in different stages of condensation or evaporation?
So he is trying to reduce all the complexity of the world down to one single element.
Exactly. In philosophy, we call this monism, specifically qualitative monism. He thought the quality of the universe was singular. It's all one stuff.
Right.
And while he was wrong about it being water, modern physics is still doing exactly what Thales did. We just call the one stuff energy or quarks or vibrating strings. Thales started the game we were still playing today.
But his student Anaximander wasn't buying it.
No. And his objection was purely logical, which is really interesting. He said, look, water has a definition. It is wet, it is cool, fire is dry and hot. If the whole universe used to be just water, how did fire ever show up?
Because water destroys fire.
Right. You can't get an opposite from an opposite.
That is a solid point. You can't squeeze dry heat out of wet cold.
So Anaximander argues that the base stuff can't be water or air or fire. It has to be something neutral, something that have no characteristic so it can become any characteristic. He called it the Apeiron,
The Apeiron.
the undefined or the infinite. It is this boundlessness from which hot and cold, wet and dry sort of separate out.
That is incredibly abstract for 600 BC. He is basically describing a primordial soup or a quantum field.
He really is.
Yeah.
But then you have a third guy, Anaximenes, who looks at that and says, that is too vague. You can't do science on the undefined. So he proposes air.
Air. That feels like a step backward to Thales's.
It seems like it, but Anaximenes added a mechanism. He explained how it changes. He talked about condensation and rarefaction.
How does that work?
Well, if you thin air out, it becomes fire. If you compress it, it becomes wind, then water, then earth, then stone.
So he is linking density to quality.
Yes. He is saying that differences in quality, like hard rock versus flowing water, are just caused by differences in quantity. Just how much air is packed into the space.
Wow.
That is the beginning of quantitative science.
Okay, so we have these Milesians trying to figure out the stuff of the universe, but this triggered a much bigger, nastier fight in the source material, the fight between change and order.
The double aspect.
Yeah. Dr. Holmes used the analogy of a saucer, which I loved. If you look at a saucer from the top, it curves in concave. Look at it from the bottom, it curves out convex. It is the same saucer, but two totally different perspectives.
Right. And reality is like that saucer. You look at nature one way, and it is a chaotic mess of constant change. The seasons, aging, death, birth.
But you look at it another way, and it is rigid order. The sun rises at the exact same time. The tides follow a schedule. Math works every single time.
So which one is real? The chaos or the order?
Enter Heraclitus. He looks at the chaos and says, that is the real part. He famously said, you can never step in the same river twice.
Because the water is flowing. The river is different and you are different.
Everything is in flux. He associated reality with fire. Fire is the perfect symbol because it is a process, not a thing. It is always consuming, moving, changing.
But if everything is just fire and chaos, why doesn't the universe just dissolve into a mess? Why do we have seasons? Why do we have logic?
Right. Why doesn't it all just burn down?
That is Heraclitus's genius. He said the fire burns according to a measure. There's a formula within the flux. He called that formula the logos.
The logos. That is a heavy word.
Incredibly heavy. It means word or reason or law. It is the idea that while everything changes, the rules of change are constant. And just as a side note, the Apostle John later adapts this exact word in the Christian New Testament when he says in the beginning was the word or the logos.
Oh, wow.
But it appears here in Greek thought first.
So the game changes, but the rules of the game stay the same.
Precisely. Now flip the saucer over. On the other side, you have Pythagoras.
The triangle guy.
But he was essentially a cult leader who worshipped numbers. He didn't see fire. He saw structure.
Right.
He discovered that musical intervals, what sounds good to the human ear, are based on perfect mathematical ratios. Have the string, you get an octave.
That must have been mind-blowing for them, to find out that beauty is actually just math.
It convinced him that the universe isn't made of stuff like water or air. It is made of form. It is made of numbers. Mm-hmm. So you have Heraclitus saying everything flows, and Pythagoras saying everything is a structure.
And this leads us to the part of the lecture where my brain honestly started to hurt. Because we have these two views, change versus structure, and then Parmenides walks in and says, you're both wrong because change is impossible.
Ah, the Eleatics. This is where logic starts to eat itself. Parmenides and his student Zeno took monism and the idea that reality is one and just followed it right off a cliff.
Parmenides argued that empty space is non-being. It is literally nothing. And since nothing doesn't exist, you can't move into it. If there is no empty space, everything is a solid block. Movement is an illusion.
Imagine a subway car packed so tight nobody can move a muscle. Mm. That is Parmenides' universe.
But I can wave my hand right now. I am moving.
Parmenides would say your eyes are lying to you. He forced philosophy to choose. Do you trust your logic or do you trust your senses?
And his argument was if the logic is sound, the senses must be wrong.
Exactly.
And to prove this, his student Zeno came up with these paradoxes that drive people absolutely crazy. The tortoise and the hare is the famous one, but I prefer the millet seed.
The millet seed is a brilliant direct attack on sense perception.
Right. So Zeno says if I drop one tiny seed, it makes no sound. Zero noise. If I drop a second seed, zero noise. But if I drop a massive sack of seeds, it makes a loud thud.
And Zeno asks, how can 10,000 silences add up to a noise? Mathematically, 0 plus 0 plus 0 is 0. So if you hear a thud, your ears are hallucinating.
That is so annoying. Because we know he is wrong. We know how sound waves work now. But logically, at the time, how do they get out of that?
Well, they didn't. Not for a long time. Zeno's paradoxes on motion, like the idea that you can divide distance infinitely so you can never actually take a first step, those actually froze mathematics for centuries.
Really?
Yeah, they couldn't solve it until Isaac Newton and Leibniz invented calculus and the concept of limits.
So Zeno was actually right, mathematically speaking, given the tools they had.
He was right that the math didn't match the reality. And that forced the next generation of thinkers, the pluralists, to scramble.
Hmm.
They had to save the universe from this logical deadlock.
They had to admit that maybe the universe isn't one thing. Maybe it is many things.
Neurology.
Exactly. If you have many things, they can rearrange. And that rearrangement looks like motion.
This gives us Empedocles. He is the one who popularized earth, air, fire, and water. The classic four elements.
But he added something crucial, right? He realized dead matter won't move by itself. You need a force. He called the forces love and hate.
Which is poetic, but he basically means attraction and repulsion.
Right. Love brings elements together into complex forms, and hate breaks them apart.
But notice what is happening here. We are separating the stuff, the matter, from the mover, the force.
And Anaxagoras takes this even further. He introduces the concept of nous.
Nous. Mind. Anaxagoras looked at the complexity of the world, the fact that food turns into hair and bone, the fact that stars move in patterns, and said random forces like hate can't explain this order.
Right.
There must be a mind governing it.
No, when he says mind, is he talking about Zeus again? Are we back to religion?
Not exactly. He is not talking about a guy with a beard on a mountain. He is talking about a cosmic intelligence. A rational force that drills things into order.
Mm-hmm.
This is the birth of teleology.
Teleology, the idea that the universe has a purpose or a design.
Exactly.
So we have the table set for the ultimate showdown. On one side, you have the design crew and Anaxagoras pointing to the nose, the mind. And on the other side, you have the guy who honestly scares me the most, Democritus.
The atomist.
Democritus looks at all this debate about water, air, seeds, and love and says, no, it is much simpler. It is just atoms and the void.
Atomos. Uncuttable. He theorized that if you cut a piece of cheese in half and then half again, eventually you hit a pellet of reality that cannot be cut. It is solid, eternal, and indestructible.
And here is the reductionism again. He says everything, a king, a cabbage, a rock, is made of the exact same atoms. The only difference is how they are stuck together.
He used the alphabet as an analogy, which I love. You have roughly 20 letters. If you arrange them one way, you get a tragedy. Arrange them another way, you get a comedy. Arrange them another way, you get absolute gibberish.
The letters don't change, only the arrangement does.
Yes. Qualitative monism, because the atoms are all the same stuff, but quantitative pluralism, because they have different shapes and sizes.
But here is the dark part, the part that keeps me up at night. Anaxagoras had his nous, his mind, to arrange the seeds. Who arranges Democritus's atoms?
No one.
No one.
Nothing. Democritus argued that these atoms are just falling through the infinite void. Occasionally they swerve, collide, and hook together by pure chance. It is all just blind mechanism.
So the fact that we are sitting here having a logical conversation is just a localized accident?
A temporary swirl of atoms.
Yeah.
Like a whirlpool in a stream. Eventually the whirlpool dissolves, the atoms disconnect, and we are gone. There is no plan. There is no design. There is no logos.
That is so bleak.
It is the birth of materialism. And it set the battle lines for the next 2,500 years of Western thought.
Dr. Holmes points out that this is basically the fork in the road. You either go down the path of Plato and Aristotle, which is teleology, purpose, design, or you go down the path of Democritus, which is mechanism, atoms, and chance.
And science, for the most part, followed Democritus.
It did.
Think about it. When a biologist explains how a muscle works, do they talk about the purpose of the muscle in the cosmic mind?
No. Right, they talk about chemical levers and electrical impulses.
They talk about mechanism. We are all Democritus's children in that sense.
It really emphasizes why these guys matter. I mean, we started this deep dive joking about water and air, but they laid out the three categories that every university still uses.
The three pillars. Metaphysics, what is the world made of? Atoms. Mind. Water.
Epistemology, how do we know? Do we trust the math, like Pythagoras? Or the senses, like Empedocles.
And the big one, ethics.
Ethics is the hardest one for the atomists. If the universe is just crashing atoms with no purpose, how do you say murder is wrong? It is just atoms rearranging.
Whereas Heraclitus would say there is a logos, a universal law, and you need to align your life with it.
Exactly. If the universe has order, your life should have order. If the universe is chaos, we'll make up your own rules.
It is incredible to think that in a 200-year window, in a few trading towns on the coast of Turkey, they framed every major question we are still fighting over.
We've changed the technology, but we haven't changed the questions. We are still debating if consciousness is just neurons firing like Democritus thought or something more like Anaxagoras.
We are still debating if the universe is fine-tuned for life or just a lucky roll of the dice.
So as we wrap up, I want to leave you listening with a thought. We've been using our brains to analyze these guys today. We've been using logic.
I certainly hope so.
But if Democritus is right, if this is all just atoms colliding in the void based on blind chance, then my thoughts aren't true. They are just chemical reactions.
Right. Can a chemical reaction be true or false? It just is.
Exactly. Yeah. If I shake a bag of Scrabble tiles and pour them out and they accidentally spell E equals MC squared, that doesn't mean the tiles understand physics.
Oh, it's just an accident.
It is just a collision of matter. So if our brains are just bags of Scrabble tiles being shaken by evolution, can we trust the logic we used on this deep dive? Can we even trust science? Or is there a logos holding it all together?
That is the ultimate paradox of materialism. You are using your mind to prove that your mind doesn't exist.
Something for you to mull over while you're staring at the ceiling tonight. Look at the world around you and ask, what is the order behind the chaos? Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the source material.
See you next time.